I'm the author of Flying Hero Class and a number of other disasters.
Very good, you're hired.
Good.
Did you see your review in the New York Times?
Yes, tomorrow? Yeah, yeah.
Very, very positive review.
Yes, indeed.
I think the only reservation the reviewer had was that he would have liked to have seen some of the characters a little more developed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that was a smaller book.
Yes.
This is a smaller book.
Yes, that's right.
Some of the, well, it's not necessarily. I mean, you've written big ones and little ones.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you know when the story ends, don't you? How long to make it? It sort of tells itself in some respects, doesn't it?
Yeah. It felt to me as if it was telling itself, yeah. But there you go.
I thought it was an enormously powerful book because it deals with subjects very much in the news and something everyone is afraid of, especially the Brits and the Americans during the Persian Gulf War. I mean, travel
yes.
just stopped for fear of terrorism, which never materialized.
Yeah, I hope it never does, actually. Yeah. Sure. Yes, even out of Australia, the flights are very... you know, highly vacant. We have a growing Arab and Islamic community down there, which has never threatened any Australian institution or the lives of any Australians. You know, nonetheless, one never knows the direction from which extremism is going to come.
That's right. As I said, it never materialized. There's a large Islamic population in the United States, of course, but they're just it just didn't happen. Apparently, Saddam Hussein's influence was a lot less worldwide than had been anticipated.
Yes, I think the Palestinians are, as a race, and of course they're not all extremists any more than all the Irish are extremists, but as a race I think they're in a confused condition. They've been applauding Saddam, and yet he has, though he is a Jew killer, he has generated a situation in Kuwait in which the Palestinians are themselves being tortured and slaughtered. And surely the entire Palestinian movement must be in a mood of confusion at the moment.
Now, you've been doing a lot of traveling. You always have done a lot of traveling. You're very peripatetic. Did you have any fears, or have you ever had any fears as you've gotten onto an airliner?
Always. I am a very neurotic flyer. I time the takeoff. I find it very hard to open my eyes at liftoff. I wish the plane into its power curve after takeoff, when that period of the flight where it feels as if the captain and the co-pilot are actually pedaling, as if you're on an enormous steel tube bicycle. And the only, you know, mildly similar experience I've had, Don, was in Khartoum. My last book was about the Horn of Africa,
mm-hmm.
About the Ethiopian regime of Mengistu, which at the moment is under great threat.
The book, I should state parenthetically, was called To Asmara, and it's now out in paperback. I was able to resuscitate my original interview with you, and I always do that. I recycle the interview when the book wins an award or comes out in paperback. So
mm-hmm.
double mileage for me with To Asmara.
Okay.
But I'm sorry, I was...
Yes, well, when we were coming back from making a little film in Eritrea, in 1989, you have to get to Eritrea through the Sudan. You have to get out through the Sudan. The Sudan is a country in enormous economic and social chaos, self-chosen, a great deal of it, self-chosen by governments, not by the poor, hapless people of the Sudan. We found it very hard to get from Port Sudan to Khartoum. And so ultimately the director, the camera crew were with, hired a plane. It cost him the earth. And the five of us got on it and we ran into a sandstorm. Terrible event. I really hated it. The claustrophobia of trying to find Khartoum in a 10,000 feet high sandstorm is unutterable. Anyhow, after we landed on our second attempt, we were congratulating ourselves in this furnace heat with a murk of dust all around us when we were handed a letter from the American ambassador saying that Rafsanjani of Iran had just given a sermon in the chief mosque of Tehran calling on the faithful everywhere to kill five Europeans for every Palestinian killed in the Intifada. So we were in Khartoum for about 4 or 5 days, 4 days, 5 nights before we could get out. Every day we'd go out to the airport and queue up in the sun. The airport was guarded and closed. The civilian government was just about to give way to the present military government of Sudan, the military government which has created this enormous famine that's on there, bigger than the Irish famine in the 1840s. And anyhow, queue up every day, no civil flights, both because of the poverty of the economy and because of sandstorms. And at last, early one morning, we got out on a weekly British Air flight that comes through from Nairobi. We weren't really in any proximate danger because the ordinary Sudanese are very moderate Muslims. But the whole drift of the political drift has been towards extremism in the Sudan, as in many other countries. You know, power has fallen into the hands of fundamentalists. That's happened in Iran. It's probably happened in Iraq. It's happening certainly in the Sudan. And so while we weren't scared of ordinary Sudanese people who would be unlikely to take any more notice of Rafsanjani than would a good Westchester Presbyterian to take notice of the Reverend Ian Paisley, nonetheless, it was just nasty enough to give me a feel. That situation, Don, makes you itch inside. The helplessness makes you feel as if you've got impetigo of the soul. And it was at least a glimmering of what a hijack must be like. I once wrote a book on the Holocaust called Schindler's List. And in the research for this one, I came across a scholarly article on the mentality of hijackers and the way hijacks the sort of the contours of a hijack, the processes it goes through. And this particular expert said that a hijack plane is run in the same manner, the same mechanisms of fear and of transferring hatred from the men with the guns, same methods as were used in the ghettos of Eastern Europe. That is, if you're a passenger, you can't afford to be angry with the men with the guns because anger at them could get you killed, might end up with your charging or attacking them and being killed.
Again, parenthetically, that's exactly what happened to Cale, one of the characters
in the book.
He was very angry with these hijackers and did not hide it.
The transference of hatred sideways or anger sideways is something that happens. You see it happen in a queue at, say, Kennedy, when there's a long queue of people waiting to go through customs and immigration. You can't be angry with the officials because they've got the power to give you a very rough time, to search all your luggage, to delay you, to question every aspect of your visa and your intentions for visiting the USA. And so what happens is that in the line, husbands and wives start snapping at each other. They transfer their irritation sideways. And the same thing happened in the ghettos of the Holocaust. It happens in a plane. The hijackers, like the SS, say, look, it's not our fault. Our history is being grievous. And it's not your fault because you're, by and large, poor, dumb, innocent people. But it's these three or four people's fault, and we're going to kill them, and then we can resume a civilized relationship with you. The SS used to say, we've taken these 2,500 people out, but it's because they were non-productive and radical and troublemakers and so on. And some people in the ghetto were only too pleased to hear that. Others said nonsense and went into resistance against the SS. But some thought, yes, that's right, I remember Reuben was a bit of a radical, and Sarah didn't have a work permit. And so there is a tendency to have a residual anger against these people for being, for causing trouble. And that's what happens aboard the plane. The central character, or the narrator, McLeod, a white manager of an Australian Aboriginal dance troupe, which has done very well in the US, is treated as one of these people who are responsible for the hijackers. The hijackers say, we're not guilty, you're not guilty, but this man is guilty.
Yeah, and the hijackers seem to be relatively arbitrary in selecting their targets.
Well, I think, like the SS, I think the SS were fairly arbitrary in who they selected, but they tried to make it seem rational because that was a good means of crowd control.
Yeah, and you mentioned a moment ago that there is anger within, like the people waiting in a line at Kennedy. There was one memorable scene where the three victims of the hijackers are marched down the aisle, and the other passengers curse at them and spit at them and beat
yes,
them on the back.
Yes, some of the other passengers, yes, indeed. Yeah.
It must be very disconcerting, though, especially in this time of terrorism, to wait for the announcement on the intercom saying, this is your new captain speaking.
Yes, I can't imagine anything worse, because a hijacked plane might be a ghetto, but it's also a ghetto at 35,000 feet in the air, and that's a horrifying distance to fall. It's not an earthbound ghetto, and it's claustrophobic. And even the ordinary flight, you are aware of helplessness. It's like being anaesthetized, strapped in, totally dependent on systems with which you have no relationship at all. And therefore the helplessness on top of that, of having men who are threatening to destroy this universe in the sky, or to destroy you individually, must be unspeakable.
Now, McLeod, of course, is your hero and the narrator of this of the story. But there's another interesting character who is really in the story kind of briefly, but he makes a very sensational conclusion, and that's the American pilot of the plane who becomes extremely angry with McLeod. Is this because he had lost control? I mean, what was his motivation for this anger?
His motivation is probably that people know that if you wait, you have a better chance of saving more people than if you act precipitately. You might lose a few, but if you can spread the time out, if you can put the hijackers under stress of exhaustion, doubt, disorientation, then you probably have a better chance of delivering most of the passengers than if one of them goes crazy and does some berserk heroic thing, which may end with the explosion of the plastique in the hold and the end of the whole flight. So I think his anger is not based on dementia, but on his sense of law and order. He is God, the God of an orderly universe, as the captain of any jet is. We depend, if you're a neurotic flyer like me, you depend on his first words to see if there's any tension in his voice. And as Tom Wolfe says in The Right Stuff, pilots speak with this folksy intonation the world over, you know.
Yes, they do.
They pretend that they're not flying an enormous bomb of air, aviation fuel. They affect, quite correctly, because it's true in most cases, affect a godlike ease in dealing with all this technology. And this makes them like a folksy god up there. We never see their faces unless we're invited to the cockpit. They are the gods of order, and of course the hijackers become the gods of disorder. Occasionally God appears, but you know, like God in real life, he doesn't have the efficacy, immediate efficacy, of the men with the guns. And he waits for them to weaken and for order to reassert itself. And the god, the captain of the plane in Flying Hero Class, waits for order to reassert itself through attrition.
I'm not sure his theory is completely right, however, because there have been many instances where there have been hostage situations and standoffs that have stretched over long periods of time, and that has allowed the sides to entrench themselves. There was a prison riot about 15 years ago in New York in a place called Attica.
Attica, mm-hmm.
And it became a circus. It dragged on for so long that political activists flocked to the scene and set up booths and tried to involve themselves in negotiations, so that you really had two sides. You had the state of New York and the police, led by Governor Nelson Rockefeller, then you had the Black Panthers and a whole bunch of other groups, and it went on for days and days and days until it ended in a terrible, bloody conclusion.
Yes, indeed.
Whereas it might have been dealt with immediately, and not allowing this to be turned into a circus.
Mm, yes.
So there is another
side
view
to
this.
But this man is, the pilot is in direct communication with the hijackers. They see his face and he sees theirs. So he feels, while ever he can convince them that he is on their side in keeping the plane orderly, that he might be able to save a great number of people. As we've seen in Eastern Europe, no government, or in Romania in particular, no government is even worse than a bad government. And I think that's the principle on which the pilot is operating.
Yeah, I think so. And you're right when you say these pilots are like gods. And that's why it's disconcerting on occasion when there is an accident or pilots turn out to be drinking, you know, something like that.
Or drug taking, yes.
Or taking drugs, or it shows that they are fallible. And that worries us a little bit because, you know, we're at the mercy of this great big engine of lightweight material that could easily crash, and there's only one or two people who can save us.
Yes, indeed. I remember when I first started flying in the 60s in Australia, I went into Adelaide Airport one Sunday morning to catch the plane home to Sydney, and I was in the men's washroom, and I saw an Australian Airlines captain come in, and it could only have been the captain of our flight, come in and stand at the urinal some distance from me and begin to relieve himself. And I thought, my God, I didn't know they went to the toilet, you know. Yeah, a man who can go to the toilet can certainly crash a plane. So I'm like you. If I hear there was a US Air plane which crashed at LaGuardia a couple of years ago and both the pilots escaped the crash and simply fled because they didn't want to be tested for drugs. They turned up 2 days later when the drugs had faded from their bloodstream. I hate those stories.
Yeah. You are not bound by any subject or any location in your fiction, are you? You really seem to explore the world in terms of subject matter.
Yes, that's true. I suppose it's because I've got a nomadic temperament. The Australians, until recently, didn't like me doing that. They looked upon it as a bit of an act of cultural dereliction not to write about Australia exclusively. But they're more lenient about it now. They can see that it's not a matter of Australia or the world, it's a matter of Australia and the world.
What do they want, a regional writer or a
world-class writer? Yes, absolutely. I grew up in Australia where it was Australia or the world. There was this little protected Anglo-Celtic enclave of enormous size and enormous wealth in the Southwest Pacific, but it wasn't really heavily stitched into the world. I mean, it participated too heavily in both the world wars, but it didn't have deregulated banking. Its financial institutions weren't tied to world markets, and it had a fairly simple economy. It made a fortune selling wheat and wool and dairy produce to the rest of the world, and therefore you could live there and ignore the world. I suppose it was like Arcadian America, or I don't suppose America was ever Arcadian, but what we think of as Arcadian America back there in, say, the 1840s. Since then, of course, the country has become stitched into the world economically, politically, and culturally. So I wanted to look at Aboriginal Australian native dancers and painters away from home, away from Australia, so that their behavior in a distant place, particularly on the flight from New York to Frankfurt, would cast light back on that remote continent down there from which they came. I've had experiences of two such Australian native groups. One was a group of actors, very sophisticated in a Western sense, who acted at the Long Wharf Theatre in 1985. And ever since that time, I've wanted to write about the extraordinary planet, which is the Aboriginal planet, Australia, the centre of the world to them, and the contrast with the European planet in which many of them have to live. Many of them have to have a foot in both worlds. You know, for example, Fred Skepsy, whose latest film was Russia House, when he was a young man, he made a novel of mine called The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith about an Australian native Aboriginal. And the actor in The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, Tommy Lewis, is a very traditional man from tropical, remote tropical Australia, the Northern Territory. So he's familiar both with the mysteries of his people, which are very much like, in broad religious terms, very much like the rituals of the Hopi or the Navajo. He lived in that tribal cosmos that he carried around in his head.
They've been treated very much the same, too, haven't
they? Yeah, absolutely, yes. And he lived in the world of Hiltons and film sets and the Cannes Film Festival. And the pressure of living with a foot in both universes begins to tell on one of the characters in the novel called Bluey Kanata, mm-hmm. who is more like these actors I was with in 1985. But in 89, here in New York at the Asia Society, there were a group of Aboriginal painters from Central Australia, from really remote Australia, extremely traditional people. And I noticed about them that they don't consider art to be the basis for fame. As with the Navajo, the sand paintings began as ceremonial paintings around which a ritual was performed. That's what they were in traditional life. And since then, the coming of acrylics and Europeans and European enthusiasm has caused these people to paint them on canvas because they don't, or on board, because they would never think of hanging them in a room themselves. That's not the purpose of them. They know that we do, and we'll give them $15,000, and they'll buy a Toyota Land Rover or whatever. I was fascinated by the difference between what is art to a white Australian or a white American, and what is art to tribal people. You've got the same thing out in the Southwest, of course, where you've got this ambiguous relationship between galleries in Santa Fe, say, and weavers, traditional weavers, Navajo and Pueblo. The purpose of the original designs was decorative, but it was also religious and mysterious and magical. It wasn't simply art that you put on a wall. And I wanted to look at that because the MacLeod, the leader of the manager of the Baramat Jara dance troupe, who are on the plane and who get hijacked, MacLeod is is obsessed with fame. He's come to New York to sell his novel, and
lots of luck.
he goes down to an agent in Greenwich Village and gets faint praise for this novel he spent 3 years writing. And while he's doing that, the Baramat Jara dance troupe are dancing effortlessly into renown. They've got articles in Time. They've got a meeting with Mayor Koch. They've got all manner of what we would consider goodies and rewards falling into their lap effortlessly. And it doesn't mean to them what it would to MacLeod, the white manager, who wants to dine at the table of fame, as all we people of European descent do, and who is being prevented from doing so.
Australia, you know, I'm sure I'm looking at Australia from a very limited perspective of an American, but Australia seems to me very much like America, and in fact, Australia and Australians seem to me more like America than an English or British.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can't comment on that because you're so close to Australia, obviously. But that's my perception.
There is a difference. It is that we are not as concerned with efficiency or being hard-driving as the Yankee tradition is. We're probably more like Southerners, both in political temper and in the casualness of our life, and in the stress on leisure and so on. We were founded by, if you can call it that, by of course, young convicts who were the detritus of the European convict system, because the Americans would no longer take convicts from England after the War of Independence. Naturally enough, we had to be founded on this immense continent in the Southwest Pacific as a penal settlement.
Yeah, you know, I read the Robert Hughes book. That was really gripping, how Australia was settled.
So that America perceives itself and celebrates at Thanksgiving the fact that it was founded by the just, the redeemed, whose justification was written on their foreheads and whose tread sanctified the earth. We were founded by the offcasts of the penal system, whose crimes were written on their forehead and whose tread certainly didn't sanctify the earth, but who we feel perversely were good people in a strange way. I take a perverse joy in thinking that the Australian European Adam and Eve were these fallen creatures and that they were redeemed not by the penal system, not by any warm intention perhaps on the part of the British Home Office. They were redeemed by the place. The place redeemed them. The place was so big, and though the British thought of it as Siberia, it was really a branch of Club Mediterranee. And therefore the place itself gave them a space that was unimaginable in the old world, and that spaciousness of the place was itself redemptive. So there is that difference. Now, like any good convict, most Australians don't like working over hours. They would rather a modest affluence than to drive themselves and excel. There are strengths and weaknesses. There's a great cynicism about how much wealth can do for you. It's a very suburban nation. It wants the suburban rewards. It wants, you know, two cars and even an above-ground pool and a fridge full of beer and healthy kids and a gas-fired barbecue is very heaven. It's all most Australian males want of life. And again, Australian women seem to cherish modest affluence. So there isn't quite the drive in the society that you get in America and Japan. It's a little bit like Ireland, you know, where an Irish journalist said to me last year, Mother of God, I feel like an American. I've been to a breakfast meeting and the dentist, and it's only 11 o'clock. And the Australians are a little bit more like that, a great suspicion of how far being smart can take you. Now, the great strength of America, and also at the same time the great weakness, is this drive for success, which is simply part of the American way. It makes this society a great society for services. It makes it a great society for excellence. It has the problem that a lot of people fall off the excellence train and begin to litter the streets of New York and Washington and L.A. I admire the Americans, though, for this drive for excellence. There's a greater cynicism about it in Australia, and an enormous cynicism about political institutions. I think in America there's still a holiness attaching to the White House and to the Congress. It may not attach to a particular incumbent, but it attaches very strongly to the institution itself. In Australia, institutions are rather disrespected. It's a rather anarchic country in that way, and yet it's conservative, so the whole thing somehow works. There's no constitution in Australia that guarantees civil rights. It's merely the case that up to now no government would dare egregiously infringe upon human rights. And therefore there is as much free speech as there is in the U.S. on a practical level.
Is there any censorship as there is in Ireland?
There's no censorship, but there is, except maybe of snuff movies or something. But there is a problem that there is no uniform libel and slander law, so that it's harder for newspapers and newspaper people there to pursue scandals like equivalent of Watergate because of the variation of libel and slander laws from state to state. The absence of malice defense doesn't exist in Australia. And so although there's a great deal of freedom of expression, there are some things, you know, you couldn't have gone with that Watergate story at the stage Woodward and Bernstein did in Australia. You would have had to wait a little longer until you'd absolutely secured the facts. And that's a great weakness of the society. Another great weakness is that Mr. Murdoch owned 70% of the print media. Now, that was allowed to happen by our government, and it's a great threat to democracy, not because it's Mr. Murdoch, but I wouldn't want any individual controlling 70% of a country's print media. I don't see how a country can long remain a democracy. But, so there's some of the differences between you and us. But then on the other hand, I think there's a very strong identity of values.
Do the Australians see themselves aligned with England heavily?
It depends where you come from. The connection with the monarchy is a bit of a shibboleth, a talisman. The old Anglo-Saxon families are very tied to the monarchy. The Irish working class is not. Most new immigrants are indifferent to it. And yet there's a fear, given that there's such a suspicion of politicians in Australia, there's a fear that if we politely ask the Queen to stop being head of state that and source of the sovereignty of Australian institutions, that we'll get some political appointee. But I think we've got to swallow that fear, because it is grotesque that a nation should have a head of state who is 12,000 miles offshore.
Well, I have to tell you something very funny that my wife told me last night. Her brother is in the Secret Service. She said, "Did you know the Queen is going to visit us next month?" And I said, "Queen, what queen?" She said, "Well, we only have one queen." So there's a great feeling that the queen is also America's queen.
Yes, indeed. Though I wish we had the same constitutional relationship to her that the Americans have. Mind you, I've never loved that family. I'm definitely a Stuart. I would have died, or more likely run away at the Battle of the Boyne, fighting for the Stuarts. I've never admired this Dewar German, not very intelligent crowd that are in Windsor now. And I have to say, as an Australian, I'm humiliated to have to be forced in certain circumstances to believe that she's my head of state. I just refuse to do it.
Well, you could have a Kennedy family.
Yes, indeed.
It's not the greatest in the world, I understand, these days. Well, we're almost out of time and almost out of tape. Flying Hero Class is another terrific novel by Thomas Keneally. Tom, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
Not at all.